Mark and Peter are going to compare the question and answers, and Janine's on the roving mic, so she will come to you with the microphone where you can ask your question directly. Okay, I think that's it. I'll hand it over to Mark and Peter.
Said last night about the repeat relapser being who we're after. I have a problem with differentiating between compassion, ambulance chasing, and practical work with these guys. Can you give me any suggestions? I can't work with them when they're drunk, and I don't know when is an appropriate time to start working with them. Could you maybe give me some points on that?
Was that a problem with compassion? And I missed the other end. The
ambulance chasing.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you understand that? Yeah, you get where I'm coming from with that one?
Compassion and ambulance chasing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about compassion for a moment. for the longest time, I thought compassion meant is that better? A little better? Higher? We need to get higher. You know how to do that, come on. Is that better? Yeah? Okay. In talking about compassion, I thought for the longest time compassion meant that I was to always be soft and tender and caring, and I had pictures of that with compassion. And what I've come to know about compassion, it could be that, and compassion can also be telling the prospect, I can no longer work with you because your actions are not proving what your lips are telling me. And so you need to hit a bottom. You need to bop till you drop, and I'm going to go work with someone else. And I stand at the door ready for you. I never give up on anyone, because if they would have given up on me, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, right? But I stand at the door. But your actions are what I'm going to be paying attention to, and that will tell me how teachable you really are. And I'll work with you, and try to raise the bottom and get you to see truth. One of the great things is allowing the prospect to become aware of his illness, working on him, and then it's time to move on if that don't work. I may be prolonging the drunk by constantly protecting you and shielding you from the untreated alcoholism that needs to be shown. Make sense? Uh-huh.
Yeah, Mark, alcoholic. I don't know if there's such a thing as reincarnation, but if there is, I must not have been a very nice man in the last one, because I work with people that have a lot of relapse history. When I think about your question, you know, the chapter Working with Others gives me some real clear instructions in there. I don't waste time working with someone who cannot or will not. In all the years I've been around, I only met two cannots. The rest are will nots. I don't spend a lot of time talking to someone who's drunk. You know, I schedule the first meeting. I take about 20 minutes, and I explain to them about the program. And I go through the steps and what they're going to have to do. And then I say, you think about that. 2-3 days. You want to do that? Call me back. If their actions show me they don't care about themselves, then I cannot and will not. If their actions show me they care, then I must. So that's how I do that. and I work with a lot of chronic relapses. What I do know about them is the last thing you want to get trapped by with a chronic person with chronic relapse is sentiment. You know, and I don't see, I'm free of this idea that death is bad. I don't know if it is or it isn't. You know, there's this idea everyone's supposed to die sober. I don't know. You know, I take what's in front of me and I take what I'm dealing with. And I just follow those instructions as they're laid out in the book. But I'm not in the rescue, fix it, cure it business. See?
There's a great great story in Alcoholic Number 3 in our big book. And Bill and Bob pay a visit on Bill Dodson. And as Bill Dodson's writing this story, he overhears Bill and Bob saying to each other, "Do you think he's worth saving?" Now that's going to ruffle a lot of feathers in some AA meetings where we're so interested in your issues and your triggers and your feelings are so important to me. And don't upset the drunk, you know, they may leave. They would just, is this guy willing to do what we tell him to do, willing to go to any lengths? Sometimes you'll work with a drunk and they'll, you're willing to go to any lengths to recover, and there's a pause. That's usually a good idea that they're not, because they're considering or trying to figure out what any lengths is going to look like before it gets there.
This question is for Peter. Earlier you were talking about meditation when you first started, and you made a comment that when you started the meditation, your thoughts would sometimes go elsewhere, and you said that you learned to just go that direction, and I didn't understand that. Can you explain a little bit on that?
My experience getting away from that was not to get attached to it. See, I would try to fight those thoughts that were coming into my mind, and I'm not going to think about this. I'm not going to think about this. And all I did was think about it. So instead of fighting it, I just see it, and then I was told to bring it back to breath. I hear the fire truck going down the street, and my first thing would be, I'm not going to pay attention to that fire truck. What am I doing? I'm paying attention to the fire truck, and I'm creating more struggle. So, okay, fire truck. Back to breath. Got to be at work in a little while. Okay, got to go to work. Back to breath. And little by slowly, that stuff starts to lose its power. And, you know, how do I get to practice meditation at a deeper level is by practicing meditation. You know, the way you get good at writing inventory is because you write inventory.
Doesn't seem like a shy audience, the lady over there.
Thanks. Yeah, Marianne, I'm an alcoholic. My question is to do with untreated alcoholism and self-will. Recently, I think I've been very much in untreated alcoholism and trying to use my self-will to overcome that. I've been in the kind of, you know, the madness in the circular thinking, etc., of kind of what's wrong with me, how to sort this out. But the particular question is about, it appears that my self-will has been saying, I'm not going to let a higher power into my life or into this problem. So the question is I don't know, it's about that resistance, that self-will of I'm determined to take myself to the gates of insanity and death, and how to kind of overcome or get rid of that self-will that wants me dead and wants me drinking. So does that make sense?
Unfortunately, yes, it does make sense. There's a line in the big book when we read our instructions after the three inventories before we move to the fifth step. It says, we hope you are convinced now that God can remove every self-will has you blocked off from God. Your self-will, you can do nothing about on your power. That's what my experience is, particularly with the middle steps. 4 through 9, in particular the writing of the inventories, 5, six, seven, the list, and the amends. That's where if I go to what I call the death of self-will. But your self-will cannot and will not ever eliminate your self-will. That's impossible. Now, there's a sentence. The third step decision is made at the bottom of page 62. The prayer is not the decision. The prayer is an affirmation of a decision. And there's a little line stuck in there that we never talk about. I think we're afraid to. It says, with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. What does that mean? It means with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. But we don't want to say that can happen in the rooms. I don't know why the movement to stay sick is so prevalent. It's not a movement I participate. But back to your question, if your experience is like mine, when you run into the wall enough times, and like me, it probably is going to take you more than one, you get into enough pain and suffering about being driven, then you're probably going to reconsider the first three propositions, write your inventory, do 5, 6, 7, 8, and then that very same self-will that was driving you is gone. Make sense?
I am Michael, I'm a recovered alcoholic. The question is a statement, yes or no. If you haven't done step 10, you haven't had a spiritual awakening, yes or no?
Who are you directing at, sir?
Both of you, then.
Yeah. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and nothing less than these steps, and they're talking about our 12 steps. Step 10 says, I've entered the world of the spirit, but I need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. If I'm not doing step 10, how can that happen? It's like doing a few amends and thinking I've entered the world of the spirit, or I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing three or four amends in step 9, and I still have about 30 more to go. Have I really had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps?
No. More questions? Step right up to The Price is Right.
Hi, I'm Colin. Welcome. I believe I've got a good recovery and we're at the 12 steps, had a spiritual experience. I'm struggling with a certain part of my recovery, and that's intimate sexual relationships. And I pray every day, I meditate. And I've done a lot of inventory work on that particular area in my life, and I've also been to see a therapist about it, but I seem unable to let go of it. I think I know what God wants for me, but at the moment I seem unable to let go of it. I wonder what you could advise.
I didn't understand that. You explained, but I didn't understand the question.
Letting go of my behavior in intimate sexual relationships.
Letting go of your behavior?
That's right.
Is that like moral and philosophical convictions, Gloria, that you can't live up to?
Possibly.
See, the big book talks about being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I'm going to make an assumption here. You're describing some behavior that you're being driven, and that you do that you would like to not do. Is that what I'm hearing? Well, it really is back to my earlier response. My experience with that is my selfishness and self-centeredness is still driving me in spite of my convictions. So what I'm still up against is self-will. And my self-will cannot eliminate my self-will. I have to take it to the process. So I go back into inventory with it. My story is much like yours. In this area of relationships, lots of inventory, lots of work. Remember, there's no arrival place. In your question, I hear you think there's some arrival place. It's an inward, circular, and no place is no better or no different. It is just different. But there's no arrival place to it. I can tell you that over time, spiritual progress, you will. I will say this. The biggest barrier to me in having any kind of intimate relationships with people was fear. The more that you are free of fear, the more intimate you are able to be. Because you have nothing to lose, so what they see in you is authenticity. If you are with someone and you are afraid, you very calmly say that you are afraid in that situation. Don't know if that helped.
There's a line in the big book that says, any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And when my experience with, we'll call it inappropriate behavior, that doesn't resemble someone who claims to be on a spiritual path, that there's a part of me that believes I can fix it on my own power. There's a part of me that justifies it every time it happens. Until I get to a place where, as Mark said earlier, where the pain is so great that I'm willing to have the change happen and not stay where I am, will a change happen? But as long as I'm convinced that, yeah, I can give lip service to my life on self-will can hardly be a success, but do I truly believe that? Because there's usually a part of me that thinks I can get me past this behavior based on my own power. And so therefore the behavior will continue. Take it back to a drink. I know I need to stop drinking, but I'll have a double for now. And I'll stop tomorrow. Because there's a reservation, there's a lurking notion that it's either going to disappear on its own, or I'm going to have some control over it. One day, somehow, some way, I'll be able to control and enjoy this type of behavior. And that's delusional thinking based on the spiritual malady, the selfish and inconsiderate habits. Page 52, living like a tornado, roaring through the lies of others. My mind says, this behavior is okay, you're not really hurting anyone. And then when I finally wake up, I realize all the damage I've caused.
Yeah, well, I want to make another comment about, if I ask you a question, are you choosing to act in the manner in which you probably wish you wouldn't act, you'd probably tell me yes, correct? Would you say yes? Okay. Several years ago, I really took a hard look at the idea that I have been programmed, that I didn't choose my parents, I didn't choose my gender, and I didn't choose a single belief system that I developed probably up through age 10, 11, and 12. And yet here I am as an adult telling you I'm going through life making choices. And I all of a sudden, the word driven by 100 forms took on a whole other level of meaning. I assure you, I've been born and raised in Iowa, and he's born and raised in Brooklyn. We got different programming here. And what I finally started to understand when the big book talks about a psyche change and a revolutionary spiritual experience, all that's really happened to me, I'm not making different choices. I truly have been reprogrammed. But the programming goes so deep that I cannot get at it. I used to be so frustrated about that, of the moral and philosophical convictions, and I could not live up to that, and the guilt and the shame and the remorse. And I would say, why? I love God, or I love this person, and why am I acting in this fashion? And over time, that's what I finally realized. Is God's got to come, I got to bring God to full bear on that, because a lot of that is so deeply ingrained in me, I don't even know it's ingrained in me.
Is it you?
Thanks, guys. My name's Simon. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I've come to know a power greater than myself as a result of working the 12 steps. It has done for me what I could not do for myself. In the book, where it says we make use of religious people and are quick to see what they have to offer, I'm open to that, and I had no religious upbringing or understanding as a child. However, I found a power as a result of working the steps. How do I know, my question is, how do I know what religion to make, or religious people to go to make use of what they have to offer that is beneficial to my own spiritual understanding? Does that make sense?
I can only answer that on my experiences that I don't know where God's going to lead you. And I can't tell you to go see this religious group or that religious group and what people to sit with. My own experience has just been moved to go to certain places and to seek out certain people. And to my surprise, I mentioned 9/11 earlier, the answer I got that somehow put some of the pieces in order for me right after 9/11 back home was, I'm a Catholic and I heard it from a rabbi. But the thing was, I was open enough to hear someone from a religion other than the one I was brought up in, to be open to listen to him rather than shutting him down. Lay aside old ideas and express even a willingness. I don't know what kind of clothes my next teacher is going to show up in, the next religious person, the next book, what kind of cover that's going to be wearing. I just need to be open. And then I get moved. I get moved.
When starting really around 1991, when I started really working with 10-11, I was led into several different practices and or religions. It started for me, I was down in a real small town in Kerrville, Texas, where Chris is from, and a Native American medicine man was put into my life. It taught me a lot about the Red Road, and I did sweats, and I did a lot of reading, and matter of fact, I still laugh, because I built a medicine wheel in my backyard out of stones, and I used to go sit and meditate. My neighbor thought I was a Wiccan, a witch, and anyhow, so I did that for about 3 years, and then meditation was really captivating me, and so I got thrust into Paramahansa Yogananda, Autobiography of a Yoga and Self-Realization Fellowship, and I did that for a couple of years, and then I had a very profound experience one of the times through the steps, and I wound up going to read my inventory to a Anglican priest. He asked me to consider joining the Order of Saint Benedict. I said to him, "You must be crazy." I took his consideration, I looked at it, wound up joining the Order of St. Benedict, following that path for about a year and a half, had another profound experience off that, got moved into Buddhism for periods of time. So I have just, my experience is I have been led. Now the one thing I've always, I've watched people get caught up in religion and pray themselves right back to a drink. One of the things I was raised on by my mentors and sponsors was do it along with, not instead of, and I always have. I discovered the inner resource through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps, and that is my foundation and will always be. All the 11 Step stuff that I've done over the years has been added to. And along the way, lots of books, monasteries, some meditation teachers, those kinds of things. So I ultimately was led into those different disciplines, and I have found them all to be fascinating. And there is so much to learn in all of them. You got to remember, in AA, this is like kindergarten when it comes to spiritual stuff. I mean, you want to find out about meditation, go talk to some dude that's been doing it 30 or 40 years, right? Those kinds of things. So.
Right here, up front.
Hi, my name is T. David, I'm an alcoholic. In the 10th step, it says it is easy to let up on that, on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And but I've seen that there is two schools, you know, what to do if you rest on your laurels and, you know, your ego, you know, back and bigger, and your selfishness and self-centeredness is back. What I've been taught to do before is to go back through 4 and 9 and do, you know, the work again. But the more I work in this program, the more convinced I am that it's enough with step 10, 11, and 12. But I'm wondering, is it just my ego that says that to me, you know, that that's the only thing I need, or is it important to go back through the work again from time to time? You know, understand my question?
I'll start off with a question that was given to me, and it went like this: did you eat today? And the answer is yes. And the reply was, why? You ate yesterday, didn't you? And what he was getting at was the need to grow, the need for nurturing the soul, nurturing the spirit, and to continue to do this work. I was one of those guys in 10, 11, and 12, and I would go to war with you if you weren't, if you're one of those guys who continually rework the steps. And it got to a point where I was, you're in 10, 11, and 12, damn it, and that's all you have to do. And I was saying I was free. Whenever I found the need to protect and defend, starting with God, the work, the book, it usually meant there was something wrong within me and not you. And then I bottomed out with that, and I needed to go through this work again. And I got freer than I've ever been in my life, and I'm one of those people who will offer going through the work over and over again, but at the same time not being attached to that. And we talked a little bit about that. So when I get that, recently I got that, and I realized there were just some new things I could do with 10 and 11 and then go work with others. And not, part of me was maybe looking for drama, need to go through the work to fulfill an ego need, right? But just to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. But I will revisit the work. I'm one of those people now who revisit the work. And it's been a tremendous experience for me. There was a gentleman I heard speak recently, and he was beyond adamant about staying in 10, 11, and 12. And I heard me and him, and I says, the guy's probably driven by 100 forms of fear and don't want to take a look at revisiting the first 9 proposals.
Try both. Live in 10, 11, 12 a couple of years, then go back and revisit 1 through 9. This year when I went in and did all my yearly physicals, my physician recommended I do a stress test and a sonogram of my heart, which I'd never done before. It was a pretty trippy experience. And so I'm talking to him later, and everything was fine. And I got to talking to him about what I suffer from in my first step. And he could tell I was very clear on my alcoholism. And I talked to him about, he said, how is it you stay so much in touch with your, what's wrong with you? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, I mean, every day I get heart patients in here, and they could be in here for a multitude of reasons. They all got problems with their heart, and very few of them is it birth defects. It's all been imposed by them, either through, it could be smoking, it could be overweight, it could be food, it could be whatever, right? And he said they come in here and they're scared to death, and for a month or two or three, they really do what I tell them. And then he said they lose all connection with what brought them here. And then some of them die, and some of them... He said, this is a normie, this is a heart doctor, right? He goes, I think that that's a good idea that you stay in touch with what is wrong with you.
Hi, my name is Edward. I'm an alcoholic. Peter, you're the breath and the fire engine is certainly the way I was taught to meditate and how to bring myself back and not resist the thoughts about the fire engine and so forth. But there's always been a paradox for me with this, and some teachers say that using meditation will never work because you're trying to get there and there is no there to get to. And I see also a question that isn't there a bit of paradox that aren't I just exchanging the fire engine for the breath or for whatever else the gap, the space between the words, whatever I'm focusing on for my form of meditation. I was curious of your thoughts on that.
I'm sorry, but I don't get your question, though. Specifically, what's your question?
The paradox between I'm just shifting my focus from one thing to the other, but I'm still shifting my focus on something external, so that potentially my time spent in meditation is not going to get me where I'm trying to go, because there, as some would say, there's really no place to go. You see. So focusing on going from the fire engine, my breath, what's the difference? Why wouldn't I stay focused on the fire engine?
I answer from experience, if focusing on a fire engine works for you, then focusing on fire engine. I will tell you that bringing it back to breath brings me back to a presence and not listening to what my mind is telling me. The destination is the breath. And God will determine where I'm going to go in that. And I'm real clear about that. I give attention to this power, but I don't try to decide the course of the journey, because there's more struggle. And I bring up, paying attention to the noises outside or the fire truck going down a block. The reason why is because we immediately try to fight that off. And then if I pay attention to the fire truck, like you said, what's the difference between that and breath? Breath is always here. That truck is going to go away. And then what do I look for? Something else. Breath is always here. And I get to realize that I'm not even in charge of that breath. That God has given me this breath to breathe in, and God allows me to breathe out. Presence in and presence out. I was coming home from visiting a treatment center in Pennsylvania. And I'm in the truck and I'm driving home. I'm way out in the boonies in the States in Pennsylvania, and I have about a 2.5 hour drive in front of me. About an hour into the drive, I get filled with a feeling of overwhelming gratitude. And it was this, that I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out, and I have nothing to do with that. I have no power over that. And my heart is beating, and I began to weep behind the wheel of the truck. Because I realized God loves me, He's given me another breath, and God loves me another breath out. And I was real clear that when the breathing stops, God will still love me. Overwhelmed with gratitude. So the breath takes me back to that which already is, silence and God.
There's a... your question's a good question. There's a story I think of. Guy goes to a teacher, he says, I want to be enlightened. And the teacher says, well, I'm sorry to hear that. And the guy says, what do you mean? He said, because if you be enlightened, the party that wanted to be enlightened won't be around to see it. So your question really is about somebody who would be enlightened, in which case it makes no difference if they meditate or if they don't, or if it's a truck or if it's breath. I've yet to meet one in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I meditate because I like the effect produced. Matter of fact, how many of you ever heard of the author Eckhart Tolle, wrote The Power Now? I had to write inventory on him. He got taken to enlightenment at age 29. Of course, I needed to read a little deeper. He went through a lot of suffering for that to come about. But I think if that happened to folks like us, we'd just all leave the rooms, and so. But no, your question's a great one. I've had times where I took all my books and put them in the trash can and next day brought them out again. And the simplicity of all this for me now is whatever my practice is, I just do it, and I have no attachment to any outcome with it. Yeah, good. And I think the questions you bring up, meditation drove me to them. And I think there was growth in all of that. You know, it's like I was almost, there was almost a form of self-willing my spiritual life, yet at the same time, in the process of that, I got so much freer, and I was much more effective in my life and with others.
I heard a story about enlightenment also. The student shows up to the teacher and he tells him, I want to be enlightened, and I'm going to go live in a cave. I'm going to go to this place and, you know, not be around society. I'm going to meditate 8 hours a day. And he did that for 6 months and came back to the teacher and told him, and he said, am I enlightened? He says, no. He says, well, I'm going to do something else. And he goes to this far off place and goes to these extremes. He comes back, am I enlightened? Teacher says, no. Comes back about 6 months later. He said, I gave up on all of that. I've just been helping other people. Now you're enlightened.
I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for all your sharing. Have you any experience of using mantras? I took instruction in my early sobriety from a Carmelite, and he suggested it might help. I've tried it. I can't guarantee that it actually helped. Maybe breathing is the equivalent of a mantra. But the mantras he suggested range from phrases like, over the hills and far away, repeated ad infinitum, or God is good, or simply, Any experience, strength and hope?
I've worked with mantras, chanting and oming, worked with lots of things. I've been open and listened to when I was moved to go do that and seek out people who knew about that. And I've had great experiences with all of that, from candles to incense. Mark talked about sage before. A lot of different things I've been moved to, and none of them have been hurtful to me, but have enhanced the experience.
In the early years of my meditations, I work with mantras, two of them, and specifically started with one in the middle of, after about 2 years of meditation, in the middle of a meditation, got moved to another one. I did find them very helpful, because when I first started meditating, I had a chatter of 1,000 monkeys going on. I think one of the reasons alcoholics have a difficult time sticking with meditation, those of you who have meditated will know what I mean by this. I would sit, and I had no idea there was so much chatter going on till I sat with myself. No wonder I drank. It was unbelievable, because I'm listening to this all. So I had to develop some techniques, because sitting was, I'll tell you what, sitting felt violent to me, is what it felt like. So I began to work with mantras. I started with the word Rama. And over and over, and I'm an athlete, so I got daily discipline, and did that for almost 2 or 3 years, and I found it to be very, very effective. Early on, I got a couple of basics of meditation. Number one, the old Nike commercial, just do it. Number two, there's no arrival place, don't have any expectations. Got that. Number three, just do it. And somewhere in the middle of that, then I begin to have the experiences that take place in meditation. So I brought that simplicity to it. But I found them to be very, very helpful in the beginning for me.
Up front here.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. I meditated before coming into recovery, and I've meditated throughout my recovery, and I'm not up to step 11, and I'm doing step 4 and 5 at the moment. So basically my question is, when did you start meditating? And I understood from before that I can't have the full experience until I've done 4 through to 9, or 1 through to 9. to have the full experience of step 11, but I'm just wondering, you know, not that it's, is it wrong to do it now, basically, before I get to step 11?
It's interesting how you have a good and bad attached to a process. You have a good and bad attached to, right and wrong, I should say, attached to getting, trying to experience God. Is it good or bad if I do this? If am I ready? Yes. Is it going to? My experience has been, I was set out to do meditation early on and to still the mind. And my teachers didn't expect me to go anywhere further than just paying attention to breath. And where I was going to go was truly up to God. And the more of me is out of the way, the more enhanced the experience gets. And when I work with others, I teach them about prayer and breathing and meditating and trying to get silent in the morning, knowing that that's going to be maybe a difficult task for them, but why deny that? And so when they're, you know, into 10, 11, 12, it has become part of who they be now. It's already been internalized, just enhanced the experience. And I speak for myself with that.
I think it's great you're doing meditation as you're going through the process. I wish, I'm jealous. No, of all the practices over the years, the one I believe that has freed me the most for me has been meditation, and you know, I didn't come to it. You know, you can't hear, you can hear. I guarantee you, in Denver, Colorado, which is a hotbed of big book thumpers, there was a lot going on with meditation. My ears never heard any of it first 10 years. So I think it's great you're doing that. My experience, though, is this. Pay attention to how you experience yourself when you get the other side of, or into nine, and then the other side of nine versus now. I think you will find that very interesting.
Hi, Stuart, an alcoholic. I hear what you're saying about just do it with regards to meditation, but in recovery, I found that, you know, the stream of life is now full for me. You know, the daily life is packed. And I also feel that I'm spinning a lot of different plates of responsibility with regards to work, personal life, you know, step 12 and step 10. I guess my question's around, have you got any pointers in terms of integrating meditation into your daily life? Like, where did you start? You know, when did you say just do it? I mean, you mentioned earlier on about starting at 4:30 in the morning, but it might not work for everybody. So I guess, you know, any hints and tips for how you bring it into your daily life?
I have a full life, very full life, president, owner of my own company, and author, and lots of stuff. And what finally happened for me is I saw that if I was not internally centered, there's no way in the world I could work with all this. So that's when I realized that I needed to come up with a system that would work for me to keep me internally calm in the midst of this incredible one-act play God has me in. What worked for me was just setting aside that time in the morning. Now, the other thing that I do is several times during the course, in the course of the day, I have an office, I can close the door 10 minutes, set a timer 5 minutes. I will do that during the course of the day. If it works out, depending on what time I get home, I'll do another meditation there. But ultimately, if you just look at how your day flows, you should be able to find some times in there where you can get centered up. Maybe it's 5 minutes at a time. But for me, I absolutely found it necessary in order to, as this role that God had assigned me begin to look like this, I couldn't handle it. And I realized I need those disciplines more, not less. Yeah, those of you who have been around here for a while know what this looks like. the longer you're sober, your life, if you will, starts to expand, and it gets busier and fuller. And my experience is I need more of that conscious contact to handle all of that, not less. And therein lies the struggle. And it is a struggle. So keep looking for different ways in which you can do that. Some other ideas I'll throw out to you. I always set goals. Next year I've sat down to do 2 silent retreats, anywhere from 2 to 5 days, in which I will go. There's just me, silent retreat. So there's different things you can do with that whole process. But don't get trapped with too much of the busyness.
My name's Carlos, and the question is, whilst you're doing your inventory crisis, do you find... the question is... trying to get my words in. Do you find the third or fourth column, which column do you find most beneficial where you are now? I.e., you're looking at the selfish self-centeredness. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Just like to explain, or... your views on which column you find most beneficial. Like, you look at your third column, you look at your instincts, your social instincts, security instincts, and sexual instincts, or do you go directly to your fourth column? Does that kind of make sense?
I'll go first. Actually, for me, it'd be both. When I write a third column, I write a little bit different third column than you described. My third column, I take the 7 areas of self, and I don't just say the word. For example, self-esteem. Self-esteem, when I'm writing my third column, is how I see and feel about myself. Pride is how others would view me. Ambition is what I want. Security is what I need to be okay. Personal relations would be same-sex relations. Sex relations for me about belief systems I have about women, and money is me and my life tied into money. So when I put a name in column 1, and then I put in column 2 what the actual resentment is, I write a pretty extensive third column. And it is always in my third column where I am playing God. Always. Without. And God does not suffer from low self-esteem. So I write a very thorough third column. I must see where I'm playing God in this resentment. See, in order for me to even write the resentment, I have to be in judgment. I have to be God in order to do that, don't I? And then off of that, it becomes very easy for me to see where am I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. So over time, my third column has really been what shows me, has really busted me, if you will, about where I'm playing God. You remember the lines in the book, if my arrangements should only stay put, if you'd only do as I wished, that's what I'm looking for in my third column. I must see that in order for me to see how that leads me to be selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and or afraid.
The neat thing about doing inventory the way Mark just describes, by opening up the third column, a big book says we considered it carefully, and it's almost a precursor as to where my fear is going to be lying. How something affects my security, what I need to be okay. I need you to do what I want. I need you to do certain things so I feel okay, and you're not. Well, what does that mean if I really move and continue to move with that? You're not doing what I want, so I'm not getting your approval, which means you don't like me, which means you're going to go away, which means I'm going to be alone. Oh, my God, I'm going to die. Right? Put about 50 names on the list and look at that, and you wonder why we're drinking. The spiritual malady. And I get to see fear showing up in the third column, which allows me, when I write fear inventory, to take a peek at how many things in my life have been with fear. Fear, 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 the evil and corroding threat. And I like to talk a lot about fear because I've experienced so much of it. It gripped me, had me in its grip.
And if I don't continue to seek this power, fear is waiting outside. And as my sponsors told me, when it gets me, it's done when it's done, not when I say so.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
An alcoholic. Mark, I've got a question. You talked earlier about the thimble and the ocean, you know, and you said, hey, the relationship with God, if I spend 5 minutes in meditation, that is, you know, spending 5 minutes of conscious contact with God. If I spend a lot of time with my children, looking after my children, in a self-seeking fashion, is that not a form of having conscious contact with God? Is it merely restricted to my time of meditation?
No.
Thank you.
I mean, there's never a time I'm not having conscious contact. The waves are part of the ocean. I'm a part of God. I have all the properties of God. I'm not God, but yet I have all the properties of God. The same is true of you. As far as I can tell, what the steps do is wake me up to that. But in order to understand what I just said, I had to start on the beach trying to be a wave. So I had to start with those disciplines and get taken to the place where I experience conscious contact all the time. And that doesn't abate and it doesn't change. And it doesn't change whether I'm in meditation or out of meditation. But I had to do a lot of work to get to that place.
I'm a cocaine addict, and I was just wondering, in your experience, do you believe that alcoholism and addiction is the same thing? Whether it's important to find out my truth? And I don't know whether I really need to take a long, you know, just, I don't know, because I was going in saying I was an alcoholic, I was saying I was an addict, and through having a look, I've found out I'm one and not the other. And is it important, you know, when I work with people, I'm told it's the same thing. And I don't know whether I'm sitting in the right place or not. All right, thanks.
Does everybody understand the question? He's really talking about the first step. Am I an alcoholic or am I an addict? And do I think that's important? Yes, I think it's critically important. If I'm going to attempt to live by a set of spiritual principles that can't be founded on a lie, it needs to be founded on truth. I've worked in the field of addiction for 17 years. I have tremendous experience with some great doctors. Can my brain tell the difference between alcohol, heroin, Valium, cocaine? No. But by God, I better know what my truth is. So I always, anyone I work with, we're going to look at alcohol. We're going to look at a craving of the body, the obsession mind with alcohol, completely separate from any of your drug use. And then we're going to look at your drug use. We're going to look at both. My experience over the years is some people are both. Some are addicts. Some are alkies. You are best served in the fellowship that is predicated on your first step. I have watched, particularly, I see this happen with addicts in AA who wind up dying of drug overdoses, trying to get clean and stay that way in a fellowship in which they don't have what the big book says, one alky working with another alky. Now, a lot of people don't agree with me. It makes no difference to me. I'm telling you what my experience is. I buried a bunch of people. It is critically important for me to know my truth. Am I an alky? Am I a real alcoholic? Am I a real drug addict? And then once I find out my truth, let me go to the fellowship where the big book says where recovery starts with one alcoholic working with one alky or one drug addict working with one. I've been running up against this I have a man who is both an alcoholic and a crackhead. And he's getting a lot of calls from Peter's neck of the woods from alcoholic men who are in AA trying to sponsor men who use crack cocaine, and they don't understand them. So they're calling the guy that I work with because he has a lot of experience. He just does some simple stuff with them over the phone, and they're just fine. So at any rate, I don't know if I answered your question. That is my experience over the years. I help people find out the truth, and then I send them to the fellowship that speaks to them. I just went through this with a man. I met him 12 years ago. I never, ever smelled alcoholic on this guy. A pal of mine, Big Frank, says I can smell a drunk. I mean, he means sober, too. And I never smelled alcohol on this guy. And so he would be in and out and in and out. And finally, I sat down with him 2 weeks ago. And he had 1 month. And when he went back out on crack cocaine. And I said to him, Dwayne, I need to give you three considerations. He gets to talking to me. And I said, when was the last time you got drunk? He said, 1999. I said, well, when you go smoke that cocaine, do you drink? And he said, no. And I looked at him. I said, I'm an alky. And I don't care what else I ever put in my body, alcohol was never more than inches away from it. I said, I don't think you're an alcoholic. And I said, I want you to go back and really take a look at your first step. And I said, second of all, I don't think you belong in the rooms of AA. And that's why you've been trying to get clean and, quote, sober for 20 years. And the longest you ever get is about a year because you're completely in the wrong fellowship. And so you never feel part of, so you hang around the edges. So anyhow, he did that. He came back and he said, you know what? You're right. He said, I am an addict and I have no business in AA. For 2 weeks, I sent him to a pal of mine in CA, and he is happy as a pig in shit.
I sponsored a guy, well, for a short time, very short time, but I agreed to sponsor him. And all I knew about the guy was he was relapsing in Alcoholics Anonymous forever. A couple of months, go out. A couple of months, go out. A couple of days, go out. And someone introduced him to me, and I said, are you willing to go to any lengths? Yes. And I said, are you an alcoholic? He says, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Well, we sat down, did some first step work, and the guy was a pure heroin addict, never drank. But he said he was alcoholic and addict because he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I'll take you, but I was inviting him to another fellowship, Narcotics Anonymous. And he was appalled that I would suggest that to him, and said some ugly words to me, and left, and wouldn't return any of my phone calls. About a year or so went by, and hadn't seen the guy, and I was coming out of a cigar shop in New York, and who drives up in one of these big, big wheel pickup trucks, honking the horn, yells out, hey, you. And he's, uh-oh, I pissed off another one, here we go. And he gets out of the truck with all these keychains. He's, I've been looking for you. He says, I just made a year clean. And he told me, he says, I went to that place just to prove you wrong. I was so angry with you. He says, and I walked into an NA meeting. He said, I heard the back end of some guy giving a talk, and everything stopped. He knew he was home, and he's been an active member in that fellowship and got a year clean. And he visits AA open meetings, goes to the anniversaries, but he found his home. There was a guy in Brooklyn, a young guy, another heroin addict, went from heroin to smoking crack, heroin and crack, and he would be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, relapsing all the time, could not identify with the alcoholic. And I lovingly confronted him and told him I would take him to other fellowships, and some of the elder statesmen or the bleeding deacons said, leave him alone. He belongs here. Well, we have a meeting on a Sunday in Brooklyn, right across the street from this little park, and one Sunday morning they found him dead in a park of an overdose. And everyone came back to the meeting and said, we'll call him Bill. Oh, poor Bill. He didn't want it enough. What a shame. So me being me, I raised my hand and shed everyone who didn't lovingly tell him and confront him to go to Narcotics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous or to take a hit for that guy dying. Well, I ruffled a lot of feathers that morning. So I did heroin. I would go to a detox cleanup, and I walked away from that. And I would do heroin, get high, and not get high until the anxiety started and the leg cramps started and the feeling sick started and I knew it was time to go again. With drinking, I would start drinking at 1 o'clock and 10 after 1 was another drink and 20 after 1 was another drink and 30 minutes after 1 was another, and I just kept drinking and keep drinking and keep drinking. The craving was never satisfied. And the other thing was I had no power, choice, and control over the booze. With the other stuff, go into a detox or a treatment center, get out, and I wasn't running to there. What I was running to was back to booze. And that was my master with all the drugs that I did in my life.
We got time for one or two more.
Hi, my name is Emil, and I'm an alcoholic. I got a question about what's the difference between...
Where are you? Raise your hand. Okay, thank you.
I got a question. What's the difference between self-seeking and selfish?
I'm glad you asked. Selfish. Concerned chiefly or only with oneself without regard for the well-being of others. Concerned excessively or exclusively with oneself. Don't you almost get to just feel this? Seeking or concentrating on one's own advantage, pleasure, or well-being without regard for others. Arising from concern with one's own welfare or well-being in disregard of others. Now that's selfish. Self-seeking. Pursuing or seeking only for oneself the act or practice of selfishly advancing one's own fears. They're kissing cousins.
Hi, my name's Michaela and I'm an alcoholic. If you get up at 4:30 in the morning, does doing meditation mean that you don't have to sleep as much, or do you go to bed really early?
Say that one more time.
If you get up at 4:30 in the morning to do your meditation,
yes.
Does doing meditation mean you don't need to sleep as much, or do you go to bed a lot early?
Actually, that's a very interesting point. I have discovered over the years that I require a lot less sleep, I believe, because I do that. You remember in the 11th step, it talks about you and I dissipate energy. And I've discovered the less will that is available in my daily life, the less self-will, the less fear and excitement and all the rest is produced. So the answer is yes, it requires a lot less sleep. Most of the time, I will go to bed anywhere between 9 and 11. Most of the time, probably closer to 11. So I really would have to say yes, meditation has enabled me to sleep less.
There's a line in step 11 that says that I become much more efficient. I do not tire so easily because I'm not burning up energy foolishly as I did when I was trying to arrange life to suit myself. Marco has told me, he says, ask an alcoholic how you doing. I'm really tired, I'm tired, I'm so tired. Because we're trying to arrange the entire planet on the way into the meeting. Yeah.
Gentleman right here.
My name is Jason, an alcoholic. I just wondered, the question I hear a lot, how do I know what God's will is? You know, just a simple, how do I know what God's will is? Is it because I can rationalize what I think is the right thing to do, but how do I actually know if it's God's will?
And what is God's will? You can start by knowing what God's will is not.
Great question. Different things to think about. One theory is there's nothing but God there. Everything is the will of God. Another theory is that your self-will run riot is God's will. I think the book that helped me the most with this was Donald Walsh's book, Conversations with God, Book 1. Now, I'm experientially based. So, for example, one time talking with a priest, and he's telling me what's going to happen to me after I died, and I said to him, do you have any experience with that? He said, no. I said, I'm not interested in your theory. So, that book made me examine some of this question about things like free will, God's will. And I think at the end of the day, for me, the only way I could answer that is I have to take it down to my intuitive thought or feeling about something, and that I feel like I can trust. Not the mind, not what people tell me. I strongly suspect love is the ultimate answer to your question. Is my act a demonstration of love? As far as I can tell, that probably is God's will. But you're asking questions that I long ago quit trying to answer or to figure out or to... But I strongly suspect there's love or fear, and I work with that. And it seems like when I'm practicing love and or receiving love, and there's the absence of fear, everything seems connected in that space. So, don't know if I answered your question. Great question. The show is over.